For me, it was for a long time a very lonely journey. So it became a bit overwhelming. So it's a really tough and lonely journey, and you need always someone with you to really help you with that.
Welcome to Conversations with Lulu. I'm Lulu Khazan, an entrepreneur living in Dubai, an investor, a mother, and your host. My guest today is Jaleel Al-Labadi, a Jordanian entrepreneur whom I've been following for quite some time now, and I finally got the chance to meet him recently and learn more about his business, AlTibbi.com. If you haven't heard of AlTibbi, I'm sure this will change in the near future. Post-COVID, healthcare has been catapulted to the top of the list of industries that need to be digitized and disrupted. Since the start of COVID, AlTibbi has offered close to 1 million online consultations across the MENA region. At some point, they even offered 15,000 consultations in one day. In this conversation, we will chat about Jaleel's 10-year overnight success. So Jaleel, how are you?
Hi, hi.
How does it feel to have a 10-year overnight success?
Working on it. And also, it depends how you define success.
That's a great point. Have you figured it out?
I haven't figured it out yet, but I can say we are not even 1% there yet.
And the dream is to make it beyond MENA business, right? Your aspirations are bigger than that.
So the aspiration is definitely beyond MENA. It's towards covering the entire emerging markets. But it's not only geographical. It's also about what we want to accomplish with that, which is more about how we look at healthcare becoming something completely different from what it is today.
Interesting. And we're going to talk more about that. But before we jump into AlTibbi, I wanted to ask you, I feel that behind every entrepreneur, there's always a great story. There's always a tipping point, something that happens that you know, that gives you this eureka moment almost that, okay, I'm done with being an employee. I want to start my own business. Did you have such a moment, or what inspired you to say, okay, I'm going to start a business?
I can say it was an aspiration, a long time aspiration. But that eureka moment didn't happen at work. I wasn't an employee at that specific moment. It was actually in a classroom doing my MBA with my professor. We were working on a class project. And it was all about how do we promote the Arabic medical dictionary that my father had published a couple of years earlier. We had envisioned it to become all digital, etc. And we presented that in the class. And then the professor called me up and asked me if that was only for the class or it was actually something I would want to work on. So I, at that specific moment, it just dawned on me that this is something I want to actually work on.
Your father, so your father was a doctor?
My father is a doctor, he's a surgeon, yes. And he is not only a surgeon, he actually wrote multiple books about health awareness and how to spread health awareness. But his major work and the thing that he's until now the mostly proud of is the medical dictionary, which he wanted to facilitate the communication between doctors and patients in the region.
Because that's not something that existed before?
Actually, it is the first Arabic medical dictionary. It sounds unreal, but it is true. Medical dictionaries in the region are English, Arabic, French, Arabic. And part of that reason is that medical schools in the Arab world until today teach medicine in English or French, not in Arabic.
So you started basically almost a WebMD, right, in Arabic initially. Is that was the origins of the business? So you took the content and then you put it online in Arabic, and then you decided one day that I'm gonna do this full time.
Exactly.
So why? why did you decide that, okay, I'm going to forego a very nice salary, because I know that you used to work in multinationals, you know, before you did your MBA. You know, you're a young man at the time, Arab man. Obviously, the expectations are you have to raise a family and pay the bills. So you decided, no, I'm not going to get a job. I'm going to pursue this.
Yeah, it is crazy. I do admit.
How old were you at the time?
I wasn't that young, actually. I was 29.
29. Okay. And then what did you do? So you were in the US doing your MBA, and then what happened?
I picked up and came back to Jordan after about 12 years living abroad, and started thinking about how do I start the business, you know, renting an office or not, hiring people or working with an agency to develop the website, you know, all the you know, going to the government offices to register the company, working with a lawyer, you know, all that kind of stuff.
And why did you decide on Jordan?
Very great question. I don't have a straight answer for that. I think it was just a comfort zone. You know, I wanted to start a completely crazy idea, so I wanted at least my surroundings to be comfortable to me. I had family here. I had friends. I had not been living here for 12 years prior, but still, I thought it would be an easier place for me to jump in.
Okay, so you started the business. You were paying, obviously, probably out of pocket initially, and then you were making revenue.
So it took us about a year and a half before we started making any revenue from advertising. Yeah, we needed to drive some traffic before we can actually claim some advertising. At the beginning, of course, we did start making some money from Google Ads, but the real breakthrough came when we actually were approached by Shweri advertising group, and they proposed to take us on board as their medical advertising platform, and that's when we started making some real revenue.
Interesting. And that, at the time, it was the dictionary, but were you still also creating content? You were still putting like articles about health, I assume? And
Oh, yeah. I mean, think of that. When my father spent about 20 years to write a dictionary that had 15,000 terms in, let's say, about 1,000 pages. Today, Al-Tibbi has 2 million pages of content, and we cover more than 100,000 terms in terms of a dictionary kind of way.
So you started in 2011, then you had the advertising model. I know that you've decided to change the business model at some point. So what happened there?
Yeah, it wasn't an overnight thought. Let's put it there. It's just an evolution in thinking. I mean, we were making money, we were making revenues, and they were growing steadily, but it was slower than what we wanted and what we dreamed of. When you embark on this, on a journey like this, you really want to make something really big. You don't want to make it barely surviving kind of business. So when it is only barely surviving and it's just increasing 5 to 10% year on year, this is not what you'd be aspiring for. And that was leading us to frustration. And we started digging around and seeing what do patients actually want? What can we think about? And one of our major or more successful features on Al-Tibbi was actually a free Q&A platform where doctors were answering free questions to patients, and patients were adopting and increasingly using that feature. So we realized that there's something in that interaction between the doctor and the patient. A patient just wanted to read content, and that's definitely impactful and helpful, but then they wanted something more, something different. Each patient thinks that his or her case is unique to him or herself. So the generic content is not enough. They wanted something more. And that's when we started, you know, building something around that.
So the opportunity for you, you felt that, okay, it's not advertising. It has to be something different. And you decided then to go into the telehealth route?
Yes, gradually, yes. I mean, we started focusing more on and more on this free Q&A driving interactions. And then the thinking became more focused on how do we monetize that specific feature? And that's when we started experimenting with a lot of models, by the way, not only telehealth. Telehealth was the last thing that started actually succeeding, and we decided to continue with that.
So did you decide to fundraise at some point when, as you were thinking about a new direction for the business?
So yes, when we decided that advertising is not going to take us far, we decided to fundraise and to be able to switch, because we could not really go full on with advertising while we wanted to build something new. And that's when we started approaching investors. And it was a really tough call, because all they were seeing was advertising, while we wanted to pitch that we wanted to get out of advertising and do something unproven.
But you got money ultimately?
Ultimately, yes. It took us some time, but ultimately, yes, we did.
Did you have any competitors at the time, or was it like for the investor, was it a case that, okay, there's only Altibi doing healthcare, so let's just invest in them?
Actually, there was a very well funded competitor back then, and the backstory of that is, on the day we were supposed to sign the investment papers, our competitor announced a 3.2 million raise on that same day, and our investors freaked out. So it was...
and how much were you trying to raise?
Half a million.
Oh, wow. So yeah. So what happened?
we succeeded in explaining that this competitor was raising more money to do more of the same, which is more advertising, which we were seeing was not scaling. And we were pitching that we wanted actually the half a million to get out of advertising. So that was the pitch. And ultimately it worked. But yeah, that moment happened.
Is the competitor still in existence?
It is now part of a larger company.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So you raised that first check, and then that half a million, and then you went on developing the FAQ section, as you said, and you went into telehealth, and then you launched. How was it when you launched? Were you certain it's going to work? Were you certain it's the future?
No, absolutely not. We were not certain about its success. And as I told you before, we actually tried multiple things prior, and many of those earlier experiments failed. So we had no reason to believe this one will particularly succeed. Plus, there weren't many examples around the world of successful examples. There are a couple of companies in the US doing that. But their focus was entirely, actually until now, the focus is entirely on B2B, while we were trying to do telehealth direct to consumer. So asking the patient to pay out of pocket to talk to a doctor, which is until now fairly unique around the world. So there was no reason to believe this one will succeed over the others, but we were trying it anyway.
So is this something, what do you feel is something unique to our region? And you know, that kind of makes a service like Altibi important.
There are a lot of bad things about our region that make something like Altibi a needed service. We have... it's a very large region, many people. We have about 400 or 500 million people now in this region, speaking Arabic, I mean, with very bad healthcare services overall, across. We don't have any primary care infrastructure. Plus, there is a lack of doctors compared to population, if you compare that to other regions in the world. On top of all of that, insurance is not widespread. So yeah, these were the ingredients we were seeing, and that gave us some some confidence about trying a service like this and targeting consumers directly. It took us some time, of course, to make all these different little things work fine to attract and scale with consumers. But we were seeing that customers and patients were actually very adamant on this. They needed it. It had a lot of impact. We were seeing numbers going up.
How much do you charge? So, for example, for like how does it work?
We normally charge $5 a month to get unlimited telehealth consultations 24/7 with a trusted, qualified primary care doctor within 5 minutes.
Wow. And by primary care, this is a GP, basically?
Yes, exactly.
And you haven't expanded into other, like, let's say, specialties?
So we don't want to expand in the traditional sense of doing that. We want to expand vertically. So the whole idea is that patients need to see a primary care doctor before seeing a specialist. And this is our triage service. This is our first line of defense. We can actually solve 50 to 60% of the cases we're getting. And if the cases cannot be solved over the phone or chat, then we do refer to the right specialist to take care of this case. This is the way we look at it. We are trying to digitize the way healthcare is managed in Europe, for example, or the US, and do it here in a much more scalable, efficient way so that we can drive as much access as possible in this region.
That's amazing. It's funny, you know, you said the region is different. And I mean, obviously, we all know that the region is quite fragmented. And like, as an example, you know, I live in Dubai, and Dubai health insurance is mandatory, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't be here unless you have health insurance. So for example, like for me, you know, but of course, like having the ability to access someone 24/7, that's amazing. But in Lebanon, as an example, I mean, I'm Lebanese, you know, you don't really have health insurance that's mandatory, and you don't have good infrastructure. Absolutely. So when you go to the doctor, it's damn expensive. Exactly. You're talking $5. I mean, in Lebanon, it's probably, I mean, now with the lira, I can't even calculate. Unfortunately, yeah. Like what would it be? But it used to be something like 50,000 liras to see a GP, which is not cheap. So that's amazing. And $5, wow. And you're operational across the region?
So we are not in North Africa yet. We are covering the entire GCC, Levant, and Egypt. Actually, Levant, except for Lebanon, we just did launch Lebanon now because of the situation there, but normally we were out of Lebanon and out of North Africa thus far.
And I saw on your social media that you've recently said that you're waiving all fees for Lebanon at the That's moment, right. which is amazing. I'm sure many people would make use of the service. Actually, I can only imagine with all that's happening. That's great. In total, you've raised $8.5 million. That's a fairly big amount. And I'm sure, you know, post COVID, I'm sure you're cooking something at the moment. And I'm sure COVID has accelerated things for you dramatically. So, just maybe to give us an idea in terms of like pre and post COVID, can you share, some numbers? Or give some examples of, you know, how it was before and you know, the impact of COVID on your business?
Sure. COVID definitely has changed everything in terms of healthcare in this region, as well as many other things. But when it comes to Altibi itself, a couple of numbers can give an idea of how things changed. When we launched end of 2016, and until actually January 2020, we had completed 1 million consultations. And we were actually thinking this was a tremendous achievement because global companies like Teladoc took, you know, about 11 years to reach the 1 million consultations mark. So we were celebrating that as an accomplishment. And then from COVID on, as you just mentioned, we completed close to 1 million consultations in 5-6 months now. So it's a lot, you know, when you think about that in terms of the the amount of doctors we had to get on board, the trainings we had to do, the scalability, the infrastructure, all of that. And we had to do that within days and weeks to be able to serve all these consultations. Even doctors normally were hard to convince that this actually works. We had to really get them on board and train and do that. Now we have more than 1,400 doctors on our platform where we had 200 before COVID. So things have accelerated quite a lot.
Yeah, I saw in some of the information you provided me before the for our interview, you get around 20 million people basically visiting Al Tibbi every month.
That's right. That's right.
That's unbelievable. So this is the future. So how is this like? Have you had? I'm sure. I mean, since all this happened, you've been maybe thinking differently, or has it like changed your vision?
Not changed, let's say accelerated our vision into the future. So we were building things gradually, building one thing after another. Now we had to actually, we were forced to develop and push things out to the market in a much faster manner. An example to that is our clinic product, which is the software as a service product that we push to specialist doctors to use at their clinics. To manage, you know, the patient profile, patient files, etc. We were doing that. We had launched it in a beta version in 2019. We were just testing it with doctors. Then COVID hit, and suddenly this became something of a necessity. It wasn't a luxury anymore because doctors needed to see their patients and they needed to log in their data while they could not actually reach the clinic physically itself. So we had to push the virtual visits through that software and onboard more and more doctors to it as fast as possible. Our vision is still the same, which is actually to manage the entire patient journey virtually and as efficiently as possible. But it just got much more accelerated now.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your entrepreneurial journey, right? I mean, there's always tons of learnings. There's always tons of mistakes, and I what I love about entrepreneurship is one day you're on top of the world, the other day you're just in the trenches fighting for your life, which is always interesting. Did you have any like perceptions that were busted, as an example, like before you were an entrepreneur?
Yeah, definitely. I thought it would be easier. Definitely.
Yeah, they make it look so glamorous, right? Like the successful entrepreneurs of the world.
Absolutely. You read about them and the stories are always linear, you know. They did this, they did that, and suddenly they're rich and famous. And in reality, it's absolutely not that. And you realize there are a lot of circles in between that nobody talks about.
Almost 9 years, almost 10 years now. Mm-hmm. So were there points in your journey where you thought, like, this is not going to work? I'm going to shut it down, or this is not working?
Many times.
Many times?
Many times.
And what stopped you? And
I don't know. I think... sometimes, I mean, the last time I had this, I actually had one of my my major investors call me in and giving me this very big talk and encouraging me to stay on and you know, to calm down and persist. And yeah, thankfully, I listened to him. The ones before, I think there's a mix of naiveness and maybe, I don't know, maybe stupidity and maybe just sheer optimism, you know. It's just you believe, you know, it will happen, you know, just keep doing it. It will change. Thankfully for me, it worked every time. We're still in, but the journey is still long.
I've spoken to several entrepreneurs on the show already. Ooh. And one of them recently told me he was one of the co-founders of Talabat. And he said, you know, if you think entrepreneurship is being smart and hard work, like, you're wrong. It's not only that. I mean, obviously, it's for granted. But he said luck you know, plays a big role in it. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, we just started the conversation with that, right? I got lucky that my father actually wrote this dictionary, and I happened to be his son, and started helping him on it and worked with it, and got lucky that a professor actually said those words to me, and that eureka moment happened. And along the years, many lucky things happened, many less lucky things happened as well. So it's can't disagree with that statement.
So what were like some of the, major learnings or along the way, like as an entrepreneur, you've had a co-founder at some point, and then you didn't have someone, and then you have someone else. So I know you've been through that. I've been through that. So was there any red flags or any learnings that you can share?
Look, unfortunately, for me, it was for a long time a very lonely journey. I was this whole founder or this whole managing partner, at least in this journey. And I needed someone to really work with me and hold and take some of the responsibilities from me. You know, it became a bit overwhelming, and that's something I try to pass along as a lesson learned, that it's a really tough and lonely journey, and you need always someone with you to really help you with that. And that's why I was always on the look for a co-founder to help me with that. And unfortunately, I screwed up with the first two. We have a co-founder with whom we work very well and very closely, and things have become much better for me personally speaking. I don't know if it's the same for him, but at least for me, it's been much easier to manage.
Does he come from a startup background as well?
Yes, he's actually. He actually started a company in healthcare and failed at it, and then joined a startup before joining UltimBee. So yes, he is that sort of a person who actually went through the troubles himself and could pass some of these learnings to me. I'm a first-time entrepreneur in that sense. I don't have past learnings, so I had to really learn on the job from my stumbles and from my experiences. So having someone with me definitely helped.
And the red flags?
Red flags, I think these are common sense. I don't know why they didn't pass through my mind before, but now looking back, they seem very much like common sense. But it's a lot around ego. If you see a person who is in this and he wants the title of co-founder, et cetera, for the ego and for the prestige instead of actually for the work and for the company, and not actually embracing the values and the mission of the company. So yes, that's a huge red flag. I missed it twice. The third was a much better call.
That's good. So we always learn from our mistakes.
Yeah.
and what about you've raised quite a bit of money. You've done multiple rounds of funding. I know that a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with raising money, and I know that obviously the bigger the amounts, the more challenging. So are there any kind of advice or learnings on the fundraising front?
First thing I really would like to say is that fundraising is not the game itself. We're fundraising because we want to scale the company. And I feel, actually, I did myself fall into the trap that fundraising was in itself the thing to do. And you start celebrating when you're raising even more amounts. Then you realize that, wait, I'm not in this to fundraise. I'm actually in this to build a company. And fundraising is here to help me building that company, not fundraising in itself. So yes, celebrate in the sense that you found people to believe in you and give you that money to scale, but not focus on that journey. I got stuck into that quite a bit. Now I'm focusing entirely on building the business.
We've all fallen into that trap, by the way. We've all fallen into that trap. You're right.
I think media helps in that, right? You know, it's always celebrating the mega rounds and this company does this and this that, and they're not celebrating the company. They're celebrating that people pumped money into the company, which is not always healthy.
That's true, because you don't really know what are the numbers, you know, in the company and how healthy is their revenue and their operations. And we still see it, unfortunately, all the time. You know, I mean, this is like the major announcement. I had a chat with Philip Bahoshi of Magnet, and I told him I'd love to see one day that, you know, X company is doing $100 million in revenue, or, you know what I mean, or X million in profit or something. I think that would be... that would be great when we get to that stage versus celebrating that they raised 5 or 10 million. But I mean, again, it's still like a big achievement in a way.
I do agree. I'm not trying to discount that, but it's very, also, I mean, people need to remain with their feet on the ground and realize that, okay, they got now the big amount of money and it's now about building the company, not about, I raised this money and that this money becomes the metric of success. It's not. It's part of, or an indication, or, you know, something along the journey to indicate that you're on the right track or not.
Absolutely. And how are your dealings in general, like with the investors from this part of the world? Is there anything that, again, any advice for entrepreneurs, maybe things to look out for, or things to do when they are approaching investors, or when they're doing these very long and time-consuming discussions? Any advice there?
It's hard. They have to be very patient. This is the thing. Again, I did raise $8.5 million. That's true, but that's nothing compared to the amounts that you see now and hear in the news. Being raised every single day in this region. So the industry has been changing quite a lot. The investors themselves have been changing and growing. And so if you look back 5, 6, or 10 years ago, investors were just as new as we were to the business. So as I said, I was learning on the job, and they were too. They were learning on the job. So things were being, you know, built up. Today, I think they're much more sophisticated. Lawyers are much more sophisticated, etc. But ultimately, the most important lesson I learned is that valuation is something, the funding, the amount, etc. It's also beautiful and dandy, but then the real work is actually in the fine print, you know, in the shareholders' agreement, and what rights do you get, what rights do investors get. And this is where I used to be super naive and not understand how important they were. And then with time, you realize, you know, this is the real battle. And even if you lose a bit on the valuation, the important thing is to protect yourself and the company with those two clauses here and there.
It's interesting, because you would think that the investor and the entrepreneur's, interests, you know, should align, and the company's interests should align. And I'm surprised sometimes to hear that, founders had, for example, very punitive type of clauses in their shareholders' agreements and so on. Because if the founder loses their motivation or their incentives, then there's no business, right? I mean, what's the thinking there?
You're right. I mean, look, I in case my investors are watching, I don't mean them.
They will be watching.
I had super amazing investors. So I don't mean them.
I mean, in general, you hear this all the time, Jalil. This is not,
the reality of it is that, yes, in the theory is exactly what you were saying. We should be aligned. It's all about growing the company. And it's all about making the best for both. At the end of the day, theoretically, we're partners, and this is a partnership. We're both in reality, it's a bit different. In reality, we're people, and investors are not managing their own money; they're managing LP's money, And it took me quite some time to understand this. Sometimes they act as people, and this is not necessarily aligned with the theory of it.
So just to clarify to everyone, an LP is basically a limited partner in a venture capital fund. So these are the people that actually put in the money that the general partners end up investing. Exactly. So you're saying, okay, so the most important then lesson is to be very careful about your shareholders' agreement, assume hire very good lawyers.
Actually, so to interrupt you, you actually have to be really careful about which investors you want to take on board. This is even before the shareholders' agreement.
Do you have any flags, any learnings? Like, I'm sure you're probably fundraising, if not now, I'm sure you will very soon. So what do you look for as Jalil for Altabi?
Ideally, you'd be looking at investors who do act as the theory asks them to do. So to be aligned with you, be real partners, to be constructive and work together on building this business forward. And then when they're partners, then they do understand there are downtimes and there are uptimes, and they should be in this, in the good and the bad. This is the most important thing. How do you achieve that kind of partnership is the real work. This is where you have to, it's like, onboarding a team member or a co-founder. You have to do your job. It's a lot of common sense. You have to listen to the red flags. It's a lot of all of that. At the end of the day, think about investors as people you're getting on board. Forget the money for a minute and think about it as bringing someone on this journey, and you really want to be super comfortable with them. You will be doing mistakes. We all did mistakes, a lot of them, but ultimately this is what you keep aspiring for. Now if I'm talking to investors and it becomes serious, I do the complete due diligence of them, just as I do with a new employee I'm getting on board. I want to listen to other portfolio companies. How was their experiences with them? How was their dealings with them? How were their terms legally, and how did they act in the bad times? So you listen to all of that, and then you make a 360 understanding or impression of these investors you want to work with.
I mean, absolutely. I feel that, you know, when we started 2011, for me, like 2012, there weren't a lot of investors around. So usually the due diligence was on the entrepreneur. I think we were at a point where, you know, there's a bit of a shift now where entrepreneurs are also doing due diligence on the investors. As you said, are they the right partners for me? And I agree with you. It's absolutely critical.
Yeah, it takes maturity on both sides. I mean, this is something that is happening in this region, and I'm seeing very good signs, and I love that. I mean, if you compare that to the years we started, yeah, there's a huge shift.
I think you need the humility, Jalil. Like, the problem is sometimes that, as you said, we were all learning. Everyone was learning. The lawyers, the investors, the entrepreneurs. I mean, you know, you're a first-time entrepreneur. I was a first-time entrepreneur as well. So there's quite a bit, you know, it's not like we've done it before many times. And sometimes it's good to say, you know what, we were learning. But you don't really hear that very often from investors. There's always like a lot of confidence, a lot of, don't want to say ego, but it's as if like we knew.
It is ego. There's a lot of ego.
Yeah. everyone was learning. So I don't think there's no shame in saying that. But things are definitely different at the moment and definitely changing, which is good, which is very good.
Absolutely. I mean, before that, investors had the money and they were in the position of power. You know, there were few investors and a lot of entrepreneurs asking for their money. So they were acting as from a position of power. Today, this has changed. And you can see that. You can see that in the interactions, in the shareholders' agreements, in the term sheets. Things have changed quite a lot in that sense.
And you do spend a lot of time fundraising as a founder. I mean, if you have to, I mean, you tell me, like you've raised multiple rounds. How much time do you spend on this?
Not as much as before.
Oh, okay.
I learned my lessons.
That's good. And when you're not in the trenches, when you're not at the office, when you're not thinking of to be morning, evening, afternoon, weekends, what do you do in general? Like how do you de-stress? I'm sure you've had a lot of like anxiety throughout the years. Sometimes I went through stressful times and they were so stressful. It's like I feel physically sick, you know, my stomach actually hurts. So I'm sure at your level, you've probably been through this. So how do you de-stress or what do you do outside of Al-Tibi?
Outside of Al-Tibi, I have a big family. So they keep
how
me
big?
De-stressed. I have four kids.
Four kids, wow.
Yeah, so they take up a lot of my time. So that's a lot of de-stressing in itself. And then I do have hobbies. I do read and play sports. So I forget about Al-Tibi for some time in my day.
So do you have like a routine? I mean, you know, you read about, you know, successful people waking up at 5 o'clock and, training and doing all these things. Do you have like a routine or not necessarily?
I do, but it's not dictated by the books I read about successful people. It's mostly dictated by the family. So yeah, my son wakes me up normally at 5:36, and I have to wake up with him, play, and prepare breakfast, and then the other kids come in. So yeah, this is my routine in that sense. But yeah, I do dedicate at least half an hour to an hour to read every day. I do play sports 3 times a week.
That's great.
To eat healthy, stay healthy.
Interesting. So you keep it simple, let's say. You don't have to be very strict with yourself.
Yes, I don't believe in that. I do believe in simplicity.
Yeah, I agree with you. I feel that there's enough stress in life already than to have a routine that you have to stick to, even though some people say that it's very helpful.
Yeah, some people do. I don't.
You don't? Yeah, that's good. That's good. Do you have any parting thoughts or, you know, anything that you'd like to leave us with? Did you, you know, we started off with the definition of success, and you spoke about Al-Tibi, but what about personal success? Have you determined what that is?
I mean, personal success is definitely to be happy, to have a happy family. That's the ultimate definition of success to me. But then it becomes a bit intertwined with what we do, you know. Like many philosophers define the person for what this person does. So it becomes a bit more connected with Al-Tibi success. And I definitely do want Al-Tibi to grow and fulfill the dream we have. But I don't want to connect my personal satisfaction in life with that alone. That's the struggle.
That's very important. And by the way, that's a lot of entrepreneurs... have that. Their company's success is their success as well. But I also find it dangerous, considering, mm-hmm. you know, considering statistically, a lot of companies don't really make it. So I think, exactly. and we read a lot about entrepreneurs' depression and loneliness and all of that. So I think there's a small caveat there, and you know, always. Keep them as much as you can separate, even though, you know, it's your baby.
Exactly.
That's why
I've been through that. So, you know, you live and learn.
Yeah. When people tell you, don't take it personally. Oh, well, you know, that's my company. It's very difficult.
Exactly. Exactly. 100%.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Jalil. It was great having you on the show. For everybody that was listening, that was Jalil Al-Labadi from altubi.com. You should definitely go out and check his website. Amazing service, 24/7 doctors, $5 a month, really unbeatable. Prices and unbeatable value, I think. Definitely would love to see where Al-Tibi goes in the future. for everyone who's been listening, thank you so much. And don't forget to subscribe to Conversations with Lulu on all podcast platforms and also on our YouTube channel. Thank you so much and stay safe. And until next time, thank you so much, everyone. Bye-bye.